Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Human Services to order. It's Monday, February 25th, and I know we had scheduled a work session on Senate Bill 167, but we're going to have to reschedule that for Thursday, February 28th, because we don't have all the paperwork. And I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 387. Sandy, tell us what this one was about.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 387 had a public hearing on February 11th. It's back before us now. You might recall that during that discussion, there were concerns. Well, there are concerns about the unlicensed unregulated facilities. We also had a companion bill in committee, Senate Bill 110, that had some language that was omitted from 387. The Dash 3 amendments incorporates that language, which exempts the individual practitioners practicing as an individual massage therapist rather than in a facility. And that's the thrust of the Dash 3 amendments. We do have the fiscal impact on the Dash 3 amendments. The fiscal impact highlights that there's a one-time fee of $50 for the facility permit, but no renewal fee, but that the board has stated that the expenditure impact is estimated to be minimal. They'll be using existing staff to carry out the licensing and regulation provisions of the bill. And there's no revenue impact, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 387.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 387. Is there any discussion? Is there any oppositions? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 387 as amended by the Dash 3 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 387 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
I am 90% sure I'll be fine with this bill. I will be voting aye in committee, but I want to dive into it. Somebody that I know very well has been a licensed massage therapist, and I just want to check in with my most important constituent, my wife, find out if there might be unintended consequences of this bill, even though she's not practicing as a licensed massage therapist anymore, so I don't have to present a conflict of interest.
All right. Thank you.
But a potential, because she could go back into the business.
All right. Is there any other discussion?
I guess so.
Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Steiner
Hewitt? Aye.
Senator
Knopf? Aye.
Senator
Shields? Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair Monson?
Aye. Motion carries, and I think that Senator Knopf has not had a bill yet, and he needs to talk about massage.
I've got two tomorrow.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Well,
one's from health care.
Cool.
I don't mind carrying this bill, but I'm just saying.
It's a much better opportunity. What are you carrying tomorrow?
All right.
So it's
Senator Knopf's carrying the bill, it sounds like. That I'll close this work session on Senate Bill 387, and I'm just, we're going to hear Senate Bill 568 first, so I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 568. Sandy, bring us up to date.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 568 is at the request of chief sponsor is Senator Monis Anderson, Senator Courtney, Senator Farioli. This is a bipartisan bill that's requiring the health authority to adopt dispute resolution process to resolve disputes involving termination, extension, or renewal of contracts between healthcare entities and coordinated care organization. It also extends the sunset on the provision governing the reimbursement rates of the hospitals by coordinated care organization. This has an emergency clause and is effective on passage. And we do have all the paperwork that's necessary if the committee chooses to move the bill.
And I'd also point out that all but one of the members of this committee are sponsors
That's
of the
right.
bill, so it's probably going to do okay. So we'll start off with however you want to proceed, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you. I'm not going to get into the technical parts of the bill. I just want to thank all of the players. We have been in this health reform business for a while now, and we could not have done that without the cooperation of the hospitals and the Oregon Health Leadership Council and the governor's team.
Lori, you need to give us your name.
I need to tell you that I am Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Trout, Delwood Village, and Fairview, and thank you for reminding me of the protocol for this This bill is a part of a package delivered to the legislature, and again, I'll say, the players, governor's team, the Oregon Health Leadership Council, and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And its passage will be, it will ensure the implementation of Oregon's historic healthcare transformation. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to the panel, and thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Colmer, Governor's Office. Thank you, Senator, for leading us off here. I just wanted to set a little bit of context really quickly before handing it off to Mr. Van Pelt here to talk in more detail. So, as you know, we've, in this state, have tried to solve sort of complicated challenges and problems by all sitting around a table and working towards some solutions. And I think what you have before you today is a part of that process. In the past, the OHP budget has been a very contentious issue over the last couple of sessions, and the governor really wanted that not to be the case. And luckily, we had some partners in the Health Leadership Council, the Hospital Association, the business leaders, and other stakeholders to make sure that didn't happen. So we could come to you with a package that you all could feel good about, we all could feel good about, and we could move forward through the legislative process. As we did that, working towards the governor's recommended budget, we also, at the direction of the presiding officer, started convening a group of legislators both on the House and the Senate side, as well as many members on this committee, to help us sort of institute sort of the agreement that we've come to with our stakeholders into legislative language. So what you see before you today is a part of that conversation, so Senate Bill 568, and we urge your strong support today. And I'll pass it off to Mr. Van Pelt.
Thank you, Sean. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Van Pelt. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Providence Health and Services in Oregon and a member of the board of the Oregon Health Leadership Council. I'm here today to share with you our strong support for the passage of Senate Bill 568, the entire package of bills connected to our Oregon Health Plan budget this session. By way of background, our Oregon Health Leadership Council was formed in 2008 after Oregon's leading business associations called for providers and insurance to the table to work together to control healthcare costs. We spent 5 years working together to some great success. I'll give you some examples. First, working with the March of Dimes, Leadership Council and 35 hospitals have agreed to stop elective deliveries of babies prior to 39 weeks. This action has improved outcomes for moms and babies and had a significant impact on the number of babies requiring neonatal services. 5 health plans, 4 state insurance purchasers, and 14 medical groups have deployed 23 registered nurses to manage the care of patients with complex chronic medical conditions. This 2-year pilot project has reduced emergency room visits, hospital admissions, lab tests, and prescriptions while improving patient satisfaction with their care. And 5 health plans teamed up to reduce unnecessary high-cost imaging, which can also lead to harmful radiation exposure. The cost savings so far have exceeded $9 million. On behalf of the HealthShare of Oregon, our CCO in the Portland metropolitan area, Providence was awarded $17 million, a CMS innovation grant over 3 years that has become the springboard for a lot of our transformation work. The grant facilitates the build-out of complementary care model interventions and hiring and training of new community health outreach workers, all to achieve improved care coordination, develop enhanced system for learning and collaboration, and help our community create a sustainable system of care. Some of the highlights of that include placement of community outreach workers in 5 clinics, again, all shared within our number of systems within the metropolitan area, build out of hospital-to-home transitions in Portland area hospital medical and surgical wards, mental health intensive transition teams and standardized workflows among all our partners, expanded emergency department guide program for Medicaid and uninsured that has already touched 4,500 lives with education and guide services, with 98% of patients receiving appointments in 12 to 24 hours of being guided, and expanding the standardized discharge program for medication reconciliation. These initiatives represent just a few of the successes achieved by Oregon Health Leadership Council, and HealthShare. We're proud of our work and see great opportunity within the transformation strategy. 2 years ago, Governor Kitzhaber asked us to engage in this effort to bend the cost curve in Medicaid, and this is really where the working relationship with the health authority and the governor's office has begun to pay off. Though many of us were engaged heavily in healthcare transformation in these pilot projects, all of us are now partners of coordinated care organizations, and this work becomes essential. A part of that work, as Sean described, really meant coming up with a budget, kind of the animation or the translation of the policy ideas into how are we going to implement and do this well. When we were approached and asked how to work collaboratively on how to fund CCOs in this biennium, we knew that would be a challenge, but we all agreed to take this on. Over several months, in fact now close to a year, we have worked collaboratively with OHA and the governor's staff and the hospital association to develop policy and budget concept on which we could all agree and based on numbers we all understood. The end result with an OHP budget package that includes four important components. Continued cost reduction from increasing the efficiency in the delivery of Medicaid services in Oregon. Overall, the system must reduce an additional $350 million in costs this biennium. Passage of the OHP budget funded at levels capped by the agreement with the federal government, including uses of general fund, tobacco taxes, and the tobacco master settlement. In essence, working together, we can receive the maximum match by and expenditure limit set by the federal government in the agreement with the governor. A commitment of resources including a two-year extension of the current hospital provider assessment. In essence, hospitals have agreed to an additional assessment of 1% to create the Hospital Transformation Performance Program. This program is designed to help drive health system transformation by creating incentives for hospitals to make improvements on 3 to 5 attainable quality and patient safety goals, in essence, complementing our transformation strategy and the policy component of Senate Bill 568. Senate Bill 568 also addresses two critical components of the package, alternative dispute resolution and a two-year extension of the rate-setting policy for non-participating providers. Now, this is some detail, but I think worth highlighting for your information. The alternative dispute resolution provision was originally established in House Bill 3650, which required the Oregon Health Authority to establish by rule a process for resolving conflicts between healthcare entity, such as a hospital provider group, and a CCO concerning creation and initial contracting phase. Senate Bill 568 extends this process to the termination, extension, or renewal of that entity's contract. This is important because as we change the way we do business in the healthcare industry, we know that we will all have different approaches to that change. By establishing an ongoing process for resolving those conflicts, we expect to resolve disputes faster, with less acrimony, and to get on with the business of transforming our healthcare system and improving patient outcomes. The extension of the alternative dispute resolution process follows good business practice. The bill also extends for 2 years the current policy on non-participating inpatient and outpatient hospital rate setting. Current law provides that for non-participating providers in a CCO, the payment rate is equal to 4% less than the Oregon Health Authority established base rate for participating providers. This provision creates pressure for both hospitals and CCOs to reach a participating provider agreement as soon as possible. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you our Oregon Health Leadership Council support for the OHP budget package and Senate Bill 568. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Let's go ahead and have Dr. Goldberg make you.
I'm here just to answer the difficult questions.
Okay, all right. First of all, I want to thank you for all your work. I mean, without the hospital's huge participation in this, our reform wouldn't be happening. Are there any questions? Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, it's lovely to see two of my constituents at the table here. Mr. Colmer, you and your family are welcome to join us in District 17. Thank you so inclined. It's a great place to live. Thank you both very much for coming today. And Mr. Van Pelt, thank you very much for your leadership in this area. Couple of quick questions. The first relates to the alternative dispute resolution. I understand that there's a situation now right here in Marion County where there's a significant challenge, and I don't know if this is the right time or place to bring it up, but since we are talking about alternative dispute resolution, I'd kind of like to hear something, maybe from, this is probably not from you, Mr. Van Pelt, although the hospitals will be hearing about, have been hearing about it, I'm sure, from Dr. Goldberg or others about what, how that's going and whether the alternative dispute resolution process is coming into play and things like that.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Steiner, members of the committee. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, I'm the director of the Oregon Health Authority. We have not instituted the alternative dispute resolution process in Salem yet. I think neither of the parties have asked us to sort of go down the path as we've outlined in rule to do that. What we have done is made available a mediator to help try and mediate some of the disputes and are trying to bring some of the people together to try and work on some of the issues. So at the point in which some of those parties want to enter into that kind of a process, we're happy to do that. But quite frankly, I continue to remain optimistic that with some help and some assistance that good people will work together and make the right decisions.
That's great. I have a different question, but if you want to...
No,
okay. Okay. The other question, I'm interested, I was at one of the clinics where we had one of these nurses who was working with patients with complex chronic medical conditions, and my understanding is that that position is no longer funded, and I'd be interested to hear about what the plan is for continuing this program, because certainly implementing a great program like that, showing its success and then letting it die, doesn't strike me as, I mean, we're not just trying to bend the cost curve for OHP, we're trying to bend the cost curve for everybody and yes. Obviously offer optimal care, and I think this is much better care than having people bopping in and out of the emergency department.
So yeah, I can't speak specifically to that particular clinic, obviously, but I do know that those of us who are engaged in the concept of the medical home and engaged in the concept of kind of care management at the grassroots level are investing, in fact, more in that model. So I think that model will be funded, and one of the values, and this is something that we've worked hard on, all of us, is as we move to the new payment structures and away from some of the fee-for-service or fee-for procedures, the idea of funding both clinics and risk-accepting entities allows you to put dollars in this kind of investment. So the idea of the global budget, the idea of investing in these kinds of support services and having people practice to the top of their license, we think makes great sense. I can't speak specifically to our experience at Providence, where we've instituted this in our clinics. We have reduced a five-year cost trend in all three lines of business, commercial, Medicare, and Medicaid, by anywhere from 2 to 5%.
It's a non-trivial number. That's great. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Goldberg, occasionally we get complaints from providers in the community, whether it's a birthing center in Salem, nurse practitioner practice in Klamath Falls, who feel like they're not getting treated fairly by their CCO. This is outside the world of hospitals. Can you let all of us know what outlets those people have at this point when they have a dispute with their CCO and them not wanting to, maybe them want the CCO shifting patients over to another provider? What type of recourse do they have?
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Shields, members of the committee. Generally, when there are disputes between providers and a CCO, as there were with providers and a managed care organization, the best recourse for those organizations is to contact us as the health authority and allow us to see whether or not that's something that rises to the level of a place where we could potentially intervene. Having said that, I'll say that it is not often that we look to insert ourselves into the the business dealings and the contractual arrangements between providers and coordinated care organizations or managed care organizations. They've got to maintain a appropriate access. It's not for us to say who they can and shouldn't work with to provide that access if indeed they're not able to meet what is client choice and the appropriate access standards, or if it's felt that providers are being discriminated against on the basis of who they are. We have a process by which, if providers feel they're being discriminated against, they can, we have a set process in rule where organizations or providers can bring that complaint to us, and we will investigate it, and we've got a process by which we will investigate that.
Seeing no further comment, this is a very, has a lot of time from a lot of smart people have put their work into this. So I'd like to close the public hearing since there is no one else signed up and open a work session on Senate Bill 568.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 568 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 568 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. The companion bill, which is on the House side that is dealing with the assessment, we are hoping that we have the finishing touches put on that, hopefully by the end of the day or sometime tomorrow. It's important that it move as well.
And seeing no further discussion, clerk will call the roll.
Senator Harris?
Aye.
Senator
Knope? Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Monson? Aye. Motion carries, and I would like to carry this bill, and thank you again to all the people who have spent so much time on that. With that, I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 568 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 164. And Representative Conger, if you could come forward. And Sandy, bring us up to date.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 164 was scheduled last week, and we had to carry it over due to time constraints. This bill requires the Oregon Health Authority, with advice from the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, to adopt rules of conduct and communication standards for academic detailing. This has an emergency clause and is effective on passage.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I appreciate the time and the courtesy. I am Jason Conger, representing House District 54, which is Bend, and do appreciate the opportunity to comment just briefly on Senate Bill 164. And what I'm doing is basically just relaying some conversations that I've had with folks in Central Oregon, where I'm from, in the CCO context, I guess, coordinated care organization context. And they had some concerns and questions about the bill that I couldn't answer, so I thought it would be appropriate to bring them before you and see if they are concerns or ultimately if some changes need to be made in the bill. So my understanding is SB 164 will only allow those who meet standards equivalent to those under the U.S. Food and Drug Administration applying to communications from pharmaceutical companies regarding brand name prescription drugs. And my concern overall is that it might diminish or interfere with local efforts to provide education and information to drive better patient care and lower costs that I see occurring by observation in CCOs in Central Oregon and elsewhere. The application of the bill, I think, to the groups that I guess I'm concerned about primarily are there's a psychopharmacology committee in Central Oregon that's looking at mental health drugs. There's the Central Oregon Independent Practice Association, which is physicians. There are others involved in the healthcare delivery system in looking at the cost of prescription drugs and best practices as well. So, again, the concern is that the way that they're operating is they gather data and then they have one-on-one meetings between CCO staff and providers to relate the findings of their data examination, their data analysis, which are all local. The clinicians affected by this bill would also include schools, universities, health plans, I already mentioned IPAs, CCOs in other areas, and nonprofits, which we see playing a role certainly in Central Oregon in the healthcare reform effort as well, all of which are focused on improving patient care ultimately. So let me talk briefly about the Central Oregon CCO. It has based its efforts in this area on gathering historical local cost data to help providers, prescribers, understand the use of generic equivalents can be a first-line option in responsible care when it's clinically appropriate, which is not always, but certainly it's an option in many cases. Part of the corollary to that is that people who can't afford medications don't ultimately take them if you prescribe them. You know, the best medication left untaken is the equivalent of no medication at all. The most relevant information, I think, that the CCO can provide to prescribers right now, and when I say the CCO, I'm still talking about the Central Oregon context, which I'm familiar with, is unpublished real-world data about prescribing patterns of their peers in the community. So I don't think that that kind of information would meet the standards under this bill. Again, I'm not 100% sure, and just want to raise the concern or the question. And this information, I think, helps prescribers understand how the cost, how their prescribing patterns interact and fit the health of the entire community, and also give them a sense of the cost to the health system overall of successful and unsuccessful medication regimes. Also, things like readmission that can be impacted by this, by their prescriptions or their prescribing patterns, and the use of brand name medications when generic alternatives will work just as well. So, in a nutshell, that pretty much explains the conversations that I've had about this bill and the concerns that have come up related to our efforts at healthcare reform in the state of Oregon and the work that at least the CCO that I'm most familiar with is actively engaged in right now and the potential to detract from that. And I'd be happy to answer any questions as long as they're not complicated or technical.
Well, we can call Craig Campbell and Russ Spencer up, who will give us some more information on this.
And do you want me to?
Do you have specific? I have some questions, but not specifically for you. So if you need to go somewhere,
I do.
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Moss Anderson. Thank you.
You get it, Steve.
Well, I don't want to sit between you guys. You could be in trouble.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of Pfizer Pharmaceuticals in support of Senate Bill 164. What the bill essentially does is it restricts communications that occur specifically with both those who provide pharmaceutical dispensation and those who prescribe pharmaceuticals when currently you have commercial detailing. And I should explain, detailing is the process by which a person goes and meets with a doctor or a pharmacist and says, this is what the appropriate use of this medication is for. These are the restrictions on its use. These are the studies that indicate how it has been used successfully. That's commercial detailing currently, and pharmaceutical companies that do commercial detailing have to comply with rather rigid requirements about what information they can and cannot provide, and that's set by the FDA. So, for instance, we could never go in and say, although the FDA has only approved this pharmaceutical for this use, we've noticed it's really working well for this as well. They can't do that sort of thing. Also, when they're supporting that with studies, they have to be published studies. So they've had some sort of a third-party evaluation to demonstrate that they are accurate. And what this bill would do is it would require a similar requirement for those who are providing that information that are not pharmaceutical companies. That might be government entities. It might be a nonprofit think tank that's trying to provide information around pharmaceuticals. That's what the bill is intended to do. Now, I know that there is some concern that's been raised about what is the scope, and I'll be honest, I think that the definition of academic or counter-detailing in this bill probably can be narrowed to take care of some of the confusion. To the extent that somebody is trying to provide information to a physician or to a pharmacist saying, use this, not that, then it would probably be covered under this bill. If it's merely providing data that has been collected about general usage but doesn't say use this instead of that, that's probably fine. And to the extent that we need to tighten down the definition in the bill to do that, that's not a problem. This is not something where we're trying to play hide the ball. We want to do this right if it's going to be done. Now, currently, other than the example that you just heard and perhaps one other that Mr. Cross might mention, we don't see currently the process of academic or counter-detailing occurring in the state of Oregon. It has happened in about five other states, however. We just want to make sure that those protocols are in place before somebody starts doing it here in the state of Oregon. And with that, I can answer any questions you may have.
Yes.
I want to apologize because I just thought of this issue, and I didn't. I know I've talked to you gentlemen about this before, so I'm not trying to ambush you. But I literally just thought of this question. I'm really concerned that this would apply to continuing medical education because I talk about, you know, I present talks on various, you know, the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians has an annual scientific meeting, and we ask people to disclose if they're talking about off-label uses of medications, but we don't require that they not talk about them. And as written and as Mr. Campbell just described it, I think that continuing medical education meetings would be included in academic detailing because we are trying to educate prescribing providers about best practices on or off label. And I think we would be hard pressed to come up with a clear enough definition that would prevent that from being a problem. I will also admit, as I told you at the time, I'm a little reluctant to pass legislation about a problem that doesn't yet exist in our state, but that's a separate issue. But my biggest concern about this is how it would affect medical education, not just for physicians, but nurse practitioners or nurses or any other healthcare provider.
Madam Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, actually the bill specifically talks about continuing medical education. It requires that they adhere to requirements imposed by the Accreditation Council for continuing medical education. So that would be the restriction that would be placed on those. And as I'm not an expert on those particular restrictions, I can't tell you whether or not those would be more restrictive than what is currently occurring in continuing medical education or not. But obviously, we'd be happy to talk to you about what the impact of that would be and whether or not there's a way to mitigate that concern.
Okay.
Any other questions? Are you looking? Yes. Russ, please go forward.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Russ Spencer, representing Pfizer. Just a couple of things that I did want to add to the record. First of all, I've had a number of conversations with representatives from the Oregon Health Authority, and we want to make very clear on the record, and I think it probably would require an amendment, that this would not in any way impact the drug utilization review program that Oregon Health Authority runs. That's a safety-focused program. We wholeheartedly support it, and this is not in any way intended to affect that. We have just this moment had some conversations with Mr. Cross representing the pharmacy associations, and there are some concerns there I think that we need to look at in perfecting some language as well. I think much of it, as Craig suggested, comes around the definition of what constitutes academic or counter-detailing. Essentially, what we're looking for here is a level playing field when we're talking about very specific efforts that are targeted at driving specific prescribing results. Broad education, broad publication around information it would not be impacted by this. So I wanted to mention with Representative Conger's concerns, you know, I would want to learn a little bit more about the specifics, but when he did say that the data is used to meet one-on-one with providers to give them cost data to drive towards generic prescribing, I think it would be impacted by this bill. I think it should be impacted by this bill. Generic prescribing is certainly appropriate in many cases. We manufacture generic products. We manufacture brand name products. But what we're seeking to do is to make sure that we're all talking about the benefit and the value equation for these treatments on the same level playing field, so the same standards apply, the same restrictions. We can't go in and just talk about cost. We can't go in and cite unpublished evidence. We can't go in and recommend off-label prescribing. There are avenues for that to happen, but it doesn't happen with our folks. So I hope that provides a little bit of clarity. I apologize that we're coming to you with something that is clearly somewhat less than perfect, but it sometimes takes many eyes to identify these things, and we're very willing to work collaboratively with the folks that have concerns to address those issues.
And, Madam Chair, one other thing I'll comment on is that the idea of informing people about lower-cost solutions is certainly not a problem. It's a good practice. The problem is if that's the only thing that's provided and not a full evaluation of what the impact of the medication is, that's where it becomes more problematic.
And do you feel the drug utilization program focuses primarily on costs?
Well, are you speaking to what, Madam Chair, are you speaking to what Representative Conger mm-hmm. was discussing? I didn't get that impression. What I heard him say was that they collect utilization data from local physicians within the system, and that is certainly very appropriate and I would think quite helpful. But what he said sort of towards the end, as I understood it, and again, I just heard it for the first time too.
I had to let him go, though.
What was that they would then meet one-on-one with the prescribers within the system to talk about the cost data. And that potentially could be of concern. Again, I would really have to know an awful lot more about that. We're happy to try to address those concerns, but if it does meet sort of the standards that they're essentially trying to do the same thing as we try to do out there, then I can't understand why they would not want to have those same standards applied. And these are standards, again, you know, interactions with physicians and prescribers, you know, over the last decade or two, as some of you have been around long enough to watch this, there's been a significant change within the pharmaceutical industry and a move away from the old marketing practices of junkets and, you know, giveaways and so forth. And now we're pretty strictly bound not just by federal regulation but by a code that we adopted ourselves, the Pharma Code, which regulates how we interact with prescribers, what we can say and what we can't. And we further support a resolution from the American Medical Association to that same end. So I think that move has been only good for physicians and only good for patients, and we should make sure that we're painting with that broad brush and having everybody adhere to that same standard of performance.
And Madam Chair, we'll work with Representative Conger to see if we can address his concerns as well.
Another concern that I was worried about is the cost of this. And again, I know that's a ways and means issue, and we'll call Tom Burns up and Bill Cross in a minute, and maybe they can shed some more light on their concerns for the bill. But are there any other questions? Stay in the room.
Yeah.
Thank you. Tom Burns and Bill Cross.
I was going to say you weren't going to sit next to me.
Bill, why don't we hear from you first, if that would be all right.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Society of Health System Pharmacists. And we're concerned about the bill, and I think Representative Conger identified a couple of those concerns, as well as the sponsors, in terms of maybe an over We may need clarification on exactly what's intended by restricting academic detailing to the FDA requirements. We're concerned about the ability of universities or about the opportunities for pharmacists to look at other information, you know, regarding drugs that they may get from the community, as opposed to from, you know, the manufacturers themselves. So I think, as I say, we're in opposition as opposed, but we would like to work with the sponsors and get a better understanding of maybe what they really are intending with the definition of academic detailing and the kinds of situations that we want to ensure our pharmacists can participate in terms of other utilizing other information. And I think Senator Siner Hayward hit on one of our questions, which is, would this impact continuing education that we may offer our members? And it may be, you know, the faculty may be somebody from the university that's providing that continuing ed. So, and we briefly got a chance to talk outside in the hallway, and I think we can at least get a better understanding moving forward as to how we might be able to get our concerns addressed, or hopefully we could.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes, if I might, Madam Chair. Yeah, the more I thought about it, and I went in and read the part of the bill where it talks about continuing medical education not being included, but I think about what we do, for example, I do a lot of teaching with medical students and residents certainly are prescribing providers, but it's not accredited continuing medical education. It's just part of our standard educational practices. You know, I give talks, and my colleagues on the faculty at OHSU give talks. So I'm a little worried about how this would affect that as well. And I'm not sure how one could tease that apart without starting to get into a laundry list of what it doesn't include. I understand the concerns expressed by the people who are putting forward this bill. I'm just not sure it's quite ready for prime time, given all these other concerns. I'm just uneasy about it. I appreciate their concerns, but.
Thank you. Tom.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Tom Burns, Director of Pharmacy Programs for the Oregon Health Authority. I think when we first looked at this bill, our biggest concern was the impact on our ability to do drug utilization review. This is a process that is imposed on us by the federal government, where we actually go out and will review retrospectively the prescribing practices of doctors or how drugs are used, and then go back and educate the doctors on how they might prescribe better, more efficiently, safer, more effectively, and quite frankly, less costly for our Medicaid patients. And I noted with interest that Mr. Spencer said that he would work with us to find a way to exempt the DUR stuff, and so I think that's okay. But I think there's a couple of other issues that I think we ought to talk about. As some of you may know, I used to work for a major pharmaceutical company, and we, as every pharmaceutical company employee today, had extensive training in what we could or could not say about a drug or how we said it or what kind of conversation we had with doctors. Every single one of our handouts had to be approved by either our internal process or the FDA specifically. And I'm a little nervous when the Oregon Health Authority wants to create a preferred drug list around physical health, and hopefully if you'll pass the bill that's over in the House, mental health drugs, if we were to communicate that list of prescribed preferred drugs to a provider, whether we would have to meet the academic detailing language in this bill. Now, if we are exempt from the bill, that's another subject, but we oftentimes will put a list together, send a list to every doctor in the state, and say these are the drugs on the preferred drug list. I think to an extent that may be what Representative Cogner was talking about. CCOs do exactly the same thing. They have their own preferred drug list. They educate doctors about the drug list, how they came up with that drug list, the process by which they went through that drug list, and encourage doctors to prescribe off that drug list. Would that be something that would have to go through this process? I just don't know. I am concerned when it says the standards must, and I'm reading on page on line 19, be consistent with federal requirements that govern academic detailing by pharmaceutical companies. As I said, that is such a prescribed process today that I fear that the work that we try to do would bog down in the detail, and we simply couldn't do it. I'm not saying we can't. I'm just saying that I get concerned about that. You, Madam Chair, asked about costs. This bill asks the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee to come up with the standards. And that's something we've not done. We rather are a committee that does two things. We create the preferred drug list and we implement the DUR process. I don't know whether we have the expertise on the committee to actually come up with these standards. Again, it's something that we'd have to work with the sponsors are to figure out exactly what it is they want the committee to do, but I would be a little nervous about this. And so while the fiscal would be minimal, and I mean seriously minimal, maybe the cost of one committee meeting, when we meet six times a year, there would be a minor cost, and we could probably absorb it, but I do think it's something that we're going to have to look at. I think other than that, there is one other issue, and that is, and I apologize to Russ that I didn't raise this, but the DOJ oftentimes will enter into lawsuit settlements with major pharmaceutical companies over whatever the issue might be and get a settlement. And I know that the DOJ in the past, I cannot speak to what they are doing in the future, has oftentimes used that settlement to counter-detail the drug that was involved in the settlement. And so I'm just a little...
Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, an example is, and I'm not... I'm not holding up any settlement that's out there, but a settlement might be that you, pharmaceutical company A, convinced doctors in the state to prescribe off-label. That's a violation of the FDA laws. We enter into a nationwide settlement. We come into a settlement with the company. The company pays DOJ. DOJ now has a settlement fund. Sometimes some of those funds come back to the Medicaid program to cover the cost of drugs that shouldn't have been prescribed, but some of it is punitive. And I know that the DOJ has in the past gone out for contract to come up with a way to go back and uneducate doctors about the fact that that company has prescribed off-label, has urged you to prescribe off-label. And they have some of it's fairly elaborate, some of it is simply education programs. I don't know what this bill would do because, again, if the information has to meet FDA standards, that means that every document that the DOJ has come up with or the contractor the DOJ has come up with must meet the standards. And someone's got to look at that. Is this the FDA that's going to look at them or is this the P&T committee that's going to look at the documents that are handed out? I don't know enough about that at this point. I certainly, though, having worked for pharmaceutical industries, understand the concerns and recognize why this bill is here. I just am not sure how to implement it from a government point of view of having to come up with standards in this state relying on the federal government standards.
What would be nice for me to know is are there other states that have implemented it and how have they implemented it? I know each state is very individual and we have a great drug utilization program and it's very effective. I would like the proponents of the bill to look at the concerns that Mr. Cross has brought up and Mr. Burns, especially regarding the DOJ issues and the process issues that we would have to, that the Oregon Health Authority would have to come up with and how this is going to interact with the CCOs in their coming up with making up their own drug lists and how they're going to be educating their providers. So those are any other? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 164. And seeing no further business, we are adjourned.